So this next question we asked the audience is another kind of the numeracy question also. And I remember I asked you at the symposium about this, and it was something I really hadn't thought about until I started to talk to these docs in practice. And then I realized all of a sudden, wow, this must be a huge issue. And it started out with a case of a woman, educated patient, who'd gotten a typical debulking surgery, carbapaclitaxel, and she comes back to clinic 1 year later and says, hey, I just heard about PARP inhibitors, and she's BRCA germline 1, incidentally. She'd had a mastectomy, incidentally. And she said, what about taking it now, a year later? And actually, the doc ended up giving her olaparib. She's on olaparib, doing well. But it seems like this would be a big issue. So my first question is, again, getting back to numeracy, you described, you know, what you consider to be the natural history or the treated history when somebody gets debulking surgery and chemo, carbapaclitaxel, very, very high recurrence or progression rate. How does that change as you go through the first, let's say, 2 years? Like, how much of that risk have you lost by 2 years? And do you think whatever that risk is going to be cut by 70% if they're BRCA germline?
Yeah, that case was hard. I get emails from providers frequently, and patients are understandably desperate to be placed on the drug when they've already finished therapy and they're sometimes months and years out. And I don't want to come across as criticizing someone else's decision, but I really don't think that we have data to support late initiation of a PARP inhibitor in someone that's been off chemotherapy and doing well for a year. You may just be kind of wasting an active drug that they may need later and not preventing a recurrence.
Well, let me ask you a question. If a typical patient comes back a year later, you said that up front they'd have maybe an 85% chance of progression. A year later, if there's still NED, how has that number changed?
Well, if you look at the survival curves on SOLO-1, you have about 50% of patients have recurred by a year. So it's 20% by 6 months, it's about 50% by a year, and by 3 years, 73% have recurred. So between 1 and 3 years, we go from 50 to 73%. So there's still maybe another 10%. So maybe by 2 years, 60% have recurred. So I think your impact diminishes.
Yeah, no, I think actually those numbers would suggest you're definitely taking a risk because, like you say, there's no data. But based on your numbers, maybe there's not that much to gain. So if the residual risk is 20%, it's still substantial. I mean, maybe it would go down to 5% or something. But in the face of an unproven strategy, that looks a little less. I always thought thinking it would be higher, but that's interesting.
I mean, I feel for folks that came in at the tail end. I don't know what to tell people. But I do think the shape of the curves tell us that the impact of olaparib is an early impact. Charlie Gourley talks about this. You know, when we talk about bevacizumab maintenance, we're talking about addressing kind of the VEGF levels and things that molecular processes that make the tumors act more aggressively. So you're really impacting on those high-risk patients and trying to normalize the curves to maybe lower-risk patients. This is not the case here with olaparib. It's more addressing the clonality of the tumor. So you finish chemotherapy and you're hopefully in a complete or relatively complete response. And then you prevent whatever cells are kind of always left there from starting to become more heterogeneous and that ability to have metastases that now are different from one another. So heterogeneous clonality. So if you early on take out those cells, that's why we think maybe there's the potential for cure here. And you don't see that big shoulder at the beginning of the survival curve with olaparib. So I think, and others think, that this is an early benefit. It's why 2 years may be enough, and maybe even less is enough, but we didn't test that. So I wouldn't say that, but it's probably an early effect. And so adding something later down the line probably doesn't help, probably doesn't change the trajectory for that patient. And we just don't have data to support that. But it is a difficult conversation to have with patients.
You know, I think this information you're providing would be very relevant, of great interest, and useful. And actually, my perception of it changed after hearing what you just said. I didn't really get that exactly when we talked about it in the symposium.